desire is very often to have, and unless this part of our nature were well controlled, we might perchance find ourselves face to face with creations of our own of which we should be heartily ashamed. 3. Calmness. This is another most important point, the absence of all worry and depression. Much of the work consists in soothing those who are disturbed, and cheering those who are in sorrow, and how can a helper do that work if his own aura is vibrating with constant fuss and worry, or grey with the deadly gloom that comes from perpetual depression? Nothing is more hopelessly fatal to occult progress or usefulness than our 19th century habit of ceaselessly worrying over trifles, of eternally making mountains out of molehills. Many of us simply spend our lives in magnifying the most absurd trivialities, in solemnly and elaborately going to work to make ourselves miserable about nothing. Surely we who are theosophists ought, at any rate, to have got beyond this stage of irrational worry and causeless depression. Surely we, who are trying to acquire some definite knowledge of the cosmic order, ought by this time to have realized that the optimistic view of everything is always nearest to the divine view, and therefore to the truth, because only that in any person which is good and beautiful can by any possibility be permanent, while the evil must by its very nature be temporary. In fact, as Browning said, the evil is null, is naught, is silence implying sound. While above and beyond it all, the soul of things is sweet, the heart of being is celestial rest. So they who know maintain unruffled calm, and with their perfect sympathy combine the joyous serenity which comes from the certainty that all will at last be well, and those who wish to help must learn to follow their example. 4. Knowledge. To be of use, the man must at least have some knowledge of the nature of the plane on which he has to work, and the more knowledge he has in any and every direction, the more useful he will be. He must fit himself for this task by carefully studying theosophical literature, for he cannot expect those whose time is already so fully occupied to waste some of it in explaining to him what he might have learned down here by taking the trouble to read the books. No one who is not already as earnest a student as his capacities and opportunities permit, need begin to think of himself as a candidate for astral work. 5. Unselfishness. It would seem scarcely needful to insist upon this as a qualification, for surely everyone who has made the least study of theosophy must know that while the slightest taint of selfishness remains in a man, he is not yet fit to be entrusted with higher powers, not yet fit to enter upon a work of whose very essence it is that the worker should forget himself but to remember the good of others. He who is still capable of selfish thought, whose personality is still so strong in him that he can allow himself to be turned aside from his work by feelings of petty pride or suggestions of wounded dignity, that man is not yet ready to show the selfless devotion of the helper. 6. This, the last and greatest of the qualifications, is also the most misunderstood. Most emphatically, it is not the cheap, namby-pamby backburnless sentimentalism which is always overflowing into vague platitudes and gushing generalities, yet fears to stand firm for the right lest it should be branded by the ignorant as unbrotherly. What is wanted is the love which is strong enough not to boast itself, but to act without talking about it, the intense desire for service which is ever on the watch for an opportunity to render it, even though it prefers to do so anonymously, the feeling which springs up in the heart of him who has realized the great work of the Logos, and having once seen it, knows that for him there can be in the three worlds no other course but to identify himself with it to the utmost limit of his power, to become, in however humble a way, and at however great a distance, a tiny channel of that wondrous love of God which, like the peace of God, passeth man's understanding. These are the qualities toward the possession of which the helper must ceaselessly strive, and of which some considerable measure at least must be his before he can hope that the great ones who stand behind will deem him fit for full awakening. The ideal is in truth a high one, yet none need therefore turn away disheartened, nor think that while he is still but struggling toward it he must necessarily remain entirely useless on the astral plane. For short of the responsibilities and dangers of that full awakening, there is much that may safely and usefully be done. There is hardly one among us who would not be capable of performing at least one definite act of mercy and goodwill each night while we are away from our bodies. Our condition when asleep is usually one of absorption in thought, be it remembered, a carrying on of the thoughts that have principally occupied us during the day, and especially of the last thought in the mind when sinking into sleep. Now if we make that last thought a strong intention to go and give help to someone whom we know to be in need of it, the soul when freed from the body will undoubtedly carry out that intention, and the help will be given. There are several cases on record in which, when this attempt has been made, the person thought of has been fully conscious of the effort of the would-be helper, and has even seen his astral body in the act of carrying out the instructions impressed upon it. Indeed, no one need sadden himself with the thought that he can have no part nor lot in this glorious work. Such a feeling would be entirely untrue, for everyone who can think can help. Nor need such useful action be confined to our hours of sleep. If you know, and who does not, of someone who is in sorrow or suffering, though you may not be able consciously to stand in astral form by their bedside, you can nevertheless send them a loving thoughts and earnest good wishes, and be well assured that such thoughts and wishes are real and living and strong, that when you so send them they do actually go and work your will in proportion to the strength which you have put into them. Thoughts are things, intensely real things, visible enough to those whose eyes have been opened to see, and by their means the poorest man may bear his part in the good work of the world as fully as the richest. In this way at least, whether we can yet function consciously upon the astral plane or not, we all can join, and we all ought to join, the army of invisible helpers. But the aspirant, who definitely desires to become one of the band of astral helpers who are working under the direction of the great masters of wisdom, will make this preparation part of a far wider scheme of development. Instead of merely endeavoring to fit himself for this particular branch of their service, he will undertake with high resolution the far greater task of training himself to follow in their footsteps, of bending all the energies of his soul to attain even as they have attained, so that his power of helping the world may not be confined to the astral plane, but may extend to those higher levels which are the true home of the divine self of man. For him the path has been marked out long ago by the wisdom of those who have trodden it in days of old, a path of self-development which sooner or later all must follow, whether they choose to adopt it of their own free will, or to wait until, after many lives and an infinity of suffering, the slow, resistless force of evolution drives them along it among the laggards of the human family. But the wise man is he who eagerly enters upon it immediately, setting his face resolutely toward the goal of adeptship, in order that, being safe forever from all doubt and fear and sorrow himself, he may help others into safety and happiness also. What are the steps of this path of holiness, as the Buddhists call it, and in what order they are arranged, let us see in our next chapter. Chapter 15. The Probationary Path. Eastern books tell us that there are four means by which a man may be brought to the beginning of the path of spiritual advancement. 1. By the companionship of those who have already entered upon it. 2. By the hearing or reading of definite teaching on occult philosophy. 3. By enlightened reflection, that is to say, that by sheer force of hard thinking and close reasoning he may arrive at the truth, or some portion of it, for himself. 4. By the practice of virtue, which means that a long series of virtuous lives, though it does not necessarily involve any increase of intellectuality, does eventually develop in man sufficient intuition to enable him to grasp the necessity of entering upon the path, and show him in what direction it lies. When, by one or another of these means, he has arrived at this point, the way to the highest adeptship lies straight before him, if he chooses to take it. In writing for students of occultism, it is hardly necessary to say that at our present stage of development we cannot expect to learn all, or nearly all, about any but the lowest steps of this path, whilst of the highest we know little but the names, though we may get occasional glimpses of the indescribable glory which surrounds them. According to the esoteric teachings, these steps are grouped in three great divisions. 1. The probationary period, before any definite pledges are taken, or initiations, in the full sense of the word, are given. This carries a man to the level necessary to pass successfully through what in theosophical books is usually called the critical period of the fifth round. 2. The period of pledged discipleship, or the path proper, whose four stages are often spoken of in Oriental books as the four paths of holiness. At the end of this, the pupil obtains adeptship, the level which humanity should reach at the close of the seventh round. 3. What we may venture to call the official period, in which the adept takes a definite part, under the great cosmic law, in the government of the world, and holds a special office connected therewith. Of course, every adept, every pupil even, when once definitely accepted, as we have seen in the earlier chapters, takes a part in the great work of helping forward the evolution of man. But those standing on the higher levels take charge of special departments, and correspond in the cosmic scheme to the ministers of the crown in a well-ordered earthly state. It is not proposed to make any attempt in this book to treat of this official period. No information about it has ever been made public, and the whole subject is too far above our comprehension to be profitably dealt with in print. We will confine ourselves therefore to the two earlier divisions. Before going into details of the probationary period, it is well to mention that in most of the Eastern sacred books this stage is regarded as merely preliminary, and scarcely as part of the path at all, for they consider that the latter is really entered upon only when definite pledges have been given. Considerable confusion has been created by the fact that the numbering of the stages occasionally commences at this point, though more often at the beginning of the second great division. Sometimes the stages themselves are counted, and sometimes the initiations leading into or out of them, so that in studying the books one has to be perpetually on one's guard to avoid misunderstanding. This probationary period, however, differs considerably in character from the others. The divisions between its stages are less decidedly marked than are those of the higher groups, and the requirements are not so definite or so exacting. But it will be easy to explain this last point after giving a list of the five stages of this period, with their respective qualifications. The first four were very ably described by Mr. Mohinimon Chatterjee in the first transaction of the London Lodge, to which readers may be referred for fuller definitions of them than can be given here. Much exceedingly valuable information about them is also given by Mrs. Besant in her books The Path of Discipleship and In the Outer Court. The names given to the stages will differ somewhat, for in those books the Hindu-Sanskrit terminology was employed, whereas the plain nomenclature used here is that of the Buddhist system. But although the subject is thus approached from a different side as it were, the qualifications exacted will be found to be precisely the same in effect even when the outward form varies. In the case of each word, the mere dictionary meaning will first be given in parentheses, and the explanation of it which is usually given by the teacher will follow. The first stage, then, is called among Buddhists. 1. Manodvravajjhana, the opening of the doors of the mind, or perhaps escaping by the door of the mind, and in it the candidate acquires a firm intellectual conviction of the impermanence and worthlessness of mere earthly aims. This is often described as learning the difference between the real and the unreal, and to learn it often takes a long time and many hard lessons. Yet it is obvious that it must be the first step toward anything like real progress, for no man can enter wholeheartedly upon the path until he has definitely decided to set his affection upon things above, not on things on the earth. And that decision comes from the certainty that nothing on earth has any value as compared with the higher life. This step is called by the Hindus the acquirement of vivekha or discrimination, and Mr. Sinnett speaks of it as the giving allegiance to the higher self. 2. Parikrama, preparation for action, the stage in which the candidate learns to do the right merely because it is right, without considering his own gain or loss either in this world or the future, and acquires, as the Eastern books put it, perfect indifference to the enjoyment of the fruits of his own actions. This indifference is the natural result of the previous step, for when the neophyte has once grasped the unreal and impermanent character of all earthly rewards, he ceases to crave for them, When once the radiance of the real has shone upon the soul, nothing below that can any longer be an object of desire. This higher indifference is called by the Hindus vigyan. 3. Upagro, attention or conduct, the stage in which what are called the six qualifications, the shatsampati of the Hindus, must be acquired. These are called in play, a, samo, quietude, that purity and calmness of thought which comes from perfect control of the mind, a qualification exceedingly difficult of attainment, and yet most necessary, for unless the mind moves only in obedience to the guidance of the will it cannot be a perfect instrument for the Master's work in the future. This qualification is a very comprehensive one, and includes within itself both the self-control and the calmness which were described in Chapter 14, as necessary for astral work. B. Dhammo, subjugation, a similar mastery over, and therefore purity in, 1.S actions and words, a quality which again follows necessarily from its predecessor. C. Upati, cessation, explained as cessation from bigotry or from belief in the necessity of any act or ceremony prescribed by a particular religion, so leading the aspirant to independence of thought and to a wide and generous tolerance. D. Chittik, endurance or forbearance, by which is meant the readiness to bear with cheerfulness whatever one's karma may bring upon one, and to part with anything and everything worldly whenever it may be necessary. It also includes the idea of complete absence of resentment for wrong, the man knowing that those who do him wrong are but the instruments of his own karma. E. Samdhana, intentness, one-pointedness involving the incapability of being turned aside from one's path by temptation. This corresponds very closely with the single-mindedness spoken of in the previous chapter. F. Sad, faith, confidence in one's master and oneself, confidence, that is, that the master is a competent teacher, and that, however diffident the pupil may feel as to his own powers, he has yet within him that divine spark which when found into a flame will one day enable him to achieve even as his master has done. 4. Anuloma, direct order or succession, signifying that its attainment follows as a natural consequence from the other three, the stage in which is acquired that intense desire for liberation from earthly life, and for union with the highest, which is called by the Hindus Mumukshutva. 5. Ghotrab, the condition of fitness for initiation. In this stage the candidate gathers up, as it were, his previous acquisitions, and strengthens them to the degree necessary for the next great step, which will set his feet upon the path proper as an accepted pupil. The attainment of this level is followed very rapidly by initiation into the next grade. In answer to the question, who is the Ghotrab? Buddha says, the man who is in possession of those conditions upon which the commencement of sanctification immediately ensues, he is the Ghotrab. The wisdom necessary for the reception of the path of holiness is called Ghotrabna. Now that we have hastily glanced at the steps of the probationary period, we must emphasize the point to which reference was made at the commencement, that the perfect attainment of these accomplishments and qualifications is not expected at this early stage. As Mr. Moini says, if all these are equally strong, adeptship is attained in the same incarnation. But such a result is of course extremely rare. It is in the direction of these acquirements that the candidate must ceaselessly strive, but it would be an error to suppose that no one has been admitted to the next step without possessing all of them in the fullest possible degree. Nor do they necessarily follow one another in the same definite order as the later steps. In fact, in many cases a man would be developing the various qualifications all at the same time, rather side by side than in regular succession. It is obvious that a man might easily be working along a great part of this path even though he was quite unaware of its very existence, and no doubt many a good Christian, many an earnest free thinker is already far on the road that will eventually lead him to initiation, though he may never have heard the word occultism in his life. I mention these two classes especially, because in every other religion occult development is recognized as a possibility, and would certainly therefore be intentionally sought by those who felt yearnings for something more satisfactory than the exoteric faiths. We must also note that the steps of this probationary period are not separated by initiations in the full sense of the word, though they will certainly be studied with tests and trials of all sorts and on all planes, and may be relieved by encouraging experiences, and by hints and help whenever these may safely be given. We are apartment sometimes to use the word initiation somewhat loosely, as for example when it is applied to such tests as have just been mentioned. Properly speaking, it refers only to the solemn ceremony at which a pupil is formally admitted to a higher grade by an appointed official, who in the name of the one initiate receives his plighted vow, and puts into his hands the new key of knowledge which he is to use on the level to which he has now attained. Such an initiation is taken at the entrance to the division which we shall next consider, and also at each passage from any one of its steps to the next. Chapter 16. The path proper. It is in the four stages of this division of the path that the ten samyojana, or fetters which bind man to the circle of rebirth and hold him back from nirvana, must be cast off. And here comes the difference between this period of pledged discipleship and the previous probation. No partial success in getting rid of these fetters is sufficient now. Before a candidate can pass on from one of the steps to the next, he must be entirely free from certain of these clogs, and when they are enumerated it will be seen how far-reaching this requirement is, and there will be little cause to wonder at the statement made in the sacred books that seven incarnations are sometimes required to pass through this division of the path. Each of these four steps or stages is again divided into four, for each has, 1. Its mago, or way, during which the student is striving to cast off the fetters, 2. Its phala, result or fruit, when he finds the results of his action in so doing showing themselves more and more, 3. Its bhavaga or consummation, the period when, the result having culminated, he is able to fulfill satisfactorily the work belonging to the step on which he now firmly stands, and, 4. Its skortrab, meaning, as before, the time when he arrives at a fit state to receive the next initiation. The first stage is 1. Sotpati or Soan. The pupil who has attained this level is spoken of as the Soani or Sotpanna, he who has entered the stream. Because from this period, though he may linger, though he may succumb to more refined temptations and turn aside from his course for a time, he can no longer fall back altogether from spirituality and become a mere worldling. He has entered upon the stream of definite higher human evolution, upon which all humanity must enter by the middle of the next round, unless they are to be left behind as temporary failures by the great life wave, to wait for further progress until the next chain of worlds. The pupil who is able to take this initiation has therefore already outstripped the majority of humanity to the extent of an entire round of all our seven planets, and in doing so has definitely secured himself against the possibility of falling out of the stream in the fifth round. He is consequently sometimes spoken of as the saved, or the safe one. It is from a misunderstanding of this idea that there arises the curious theory of salvation promulgated by a certain section of the Christian community. Their onion salvation, of which some of its documents speak, is not, as has been blasphemously supposed by the ignorant, from eternal torture, but simply from wasting the rest of this onor dispensation by falling out of its line of progress. This also is the meaning, naturally, of the celebrated clause in the Athanasian Creed. Whosoever will be saved, before all things it is necessary that he hold the Catholic faith. See the Christian Creed, p.91. The fetters which he must cast off before he can pass into the next stage are 1. Sakyadithi, the delusion of self. 2. Vikikich, doubt or uncertainty. 3. Slabatapamsa, superstition. The first of these is there. I am I. Consciousness, which is connected with the personality, is nothing but an illusion, and must be got rid of at the very first step of the real upward path. But to cast off this fetter completely means even more than this, for it involves the realization of the fact that the individuality also is in very truth one with the all, that it can therefore never have any interest supposed to those of its brethren, and that it is most truly progressing when it most assists the progress of others. For the very sign and seal of the attainment of the Sotpatti level is the first entrance of the pupil into the plane next above the mental, that which we usually call the buddhic. It may be, nay, it will be, the merest touch of the lowest subplane of that stupendously exalted condition that the pupil can as yet experience, even with his master's help, but even the touch is something that can never be forgotten, something that opens a new world before him, and entirely revolutionizes his feelings and conceptions. Then for the first time, by means of the extended consciousness of that plane, he truly realizes the underlying unity of all, not as an intellectual conception merely, but as a definite fact that is patent to his opened eyes. Then first he really knows something of the world in which he lives. Then first he gets some slight glimpse of what the love and compassion of the great masters must be. As to the second fetter, a word of caution is necessary. We who have been trained in European habits of thought are unhappily so familiar with the idea that a blind unreasoning adhesion to certain dogmas may be claimed from a disciple, that or hearing that occultism considers doubt as an obstacle to progress, we are likely to suppose that it also requires the same unquestioning faith from its followers as modern superstitions do. No idea could be more certainly false. It is true that doubt, or rather uncertainty, on certain questions is a bar to spiritual progress, but the antidote to that doubt is not blind faith, which is itself considered as a fetter, as will presently be seen, but the certainty of conviction founded on individual experiment or mathematical reasoning. While a child doubted the accuracy of the multiplication table, he would hardly acquire proficiency in the higher mathematics, but his doubts could be satisfactorily cleared up only by his attaining a comprehension, founded on reasoning or experiment, that the statements contained in the table are true. He believes that 2 + 2 = 4, not merely because he has been told so, but because it has become to him a self-evident fact. And this is exactly the method, and the only method, of resolving doubt known to occultism. Vikikichch has been defined as doubt of the doctrines of karma and reincarnation, and of the efficacy of the method of attaining the highest good by this path of holiness, and the casting off of this same jhana is the arriving at absolute certainty, based either upon personal first-hand knowledge or upon reason, that the occult teaching upon these points is true. The third fetter to be got rid of comprehends all kinds of unreasoning or mistaken belief, all dependence on the efficacy of outward rites and ceremonies to purify the heart. He who would cast it off must learn to depend upon himself alone, not upon others, nor upon the outer husk of any religion. The first three fetters are in a coherent series. The difference between individuality and personality being fully realized, it is then possible to some extent to appreciate the actual course of reincarnation, and so as to dispel all doubt on that head. This done, the knowledge of the spiritual permanence of the true ego gives rise to reliance on one's own spiritual strength, and so dispels superstition. 2. Sakajma. The pupil who has entered upon this second stage is spoken of as a Sakrajmin, the man who returns but once, signifying that a man who has reached this level should need but one more incarnation before attaining arhatship. At this step no additional fetters are cast off, but the pupil is occupied in reducing to a minimum those which still enchain him. It is, however, usually a period of considerable psychic and intellectual advancement. If what are commonly called psychic faculties have not been previously acquired, they must be developed at this stage, as without them it would be impossible to assimilate the knowledge which must now be given, or to do the higher work for humanity in which the pupil is now privileged to assist. He must have the astral consciousness at his command during his physical waking life, and during sleep the heaven world will be open before him, for the consciousness of a man when away from his physical body is always one stage higher than it is while he is still burdened with the house of flesh. 3. Angmai. The Angmin, he who does not return, is so called because, having reached this stage, he ought to be able to attain the next one in the life he is then living. He enjoys, while moving through the round of his daily work, all the splendid possibilities of progress given by the full possession of the priceless faculties of the heaven world, and when he leaves his physical vehicle at night he enters once more into the wonderfully widened consciousness that belongs to the Buddha. In this step he finally gets rid of any lingering remains of the two fetters of 4.